Okay, good morning. We begin now the third and the latest one of the seminars of this series of seminars of Susan Haack. Today with the topic of truth in science and in law. Thank you.
Thank you. It works?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. I could shout. I should explain, as I just did to you, something about my title. Of truth is not an expression one would ordinarily hear in modern English. In modern English, we would say on truth. But I gave this talk its title in honor of Francis Bacon's essay, Of Truth, 3 pages long, the most brilliant English I have read in a very long time, and probably the best 3 pages on truth ever written. So, okay. Next. This talk was first presented at a conference at Brooklyn Law School, which has many distinctions, among them the most elegant logo of any law school in the country, so I decided to use it. That's Brooklyn Bridge, of course. Okay. The intended topic of this conference was interdisciplinary perspectives on truth in science and law, and I was supposed to represent philosophy. God help me. Okay. The conference announcement had many peculiarities, one of which was that it misspelled Merrill Dow in Dalbert versus Merrill Dow, but never mind. This was the core instructions to the participants. We were to consider if and how the inquiry into the reliability of proffered scientific testimony mandated by Dalbert relates to truth, and whose view of the truth should prevail. Well, I was kind of intrigued by those scare quotes. Why did the people who organized this conference feel so afraid of the concept of truth that they dared not speak about truth, but only about truth? What were they thinking? I was very puzzled. Okay, next. A legal tangle, that means, and a philosophical swamp, you're sinking into mud. Okay. Judges often say that the basic purpose of a trial is to determine the truth. This is from a Supreme Court case in 1966. But there's nothing unusual about it. It's a common thing to hear. And Janet Reno, when she was Attorney General, wrote in her introduction to a report on DNA exonerations. Same thing. Purpose of the trial is to discover the truth. I actually think that's not quite correct. I wouldn't deny for a moment that truth is crucial to substantive justice. There is nothing more substantively unjust than executing the guy who didn't do it. Okay, that goes almost without saying, but perhaps not quite without saying. Nor do I want to deny that in some trials, though by no means all, the core issue is whether this was the guy who fired the gun. Okay, that's not an issue. But the way I see it is this, that a trial is better seen as, first of all, a late stage of a lengthy process. I said a late rather than the last because I want to leave room for appeals procedures and such. A late stage of the whole process of determining guilt or liability, and I've chosen that word rather deliberately. It's more closely related to deem than to discover. Okay. Late stage of this whole process, and this whole process, at least in a common law system, is subject to legal constraints, some of which have absolutely nothing to do with the truth, or indeed pull directly against getting at the truth. For example, I don't know, there's no reason why you should be aware of this, but Federal Rule of Evidence 407B, of which I'm very fond, says that evidence of subsequent repair is inadmissible. What that means is, if you break your leg, say, on the wonky steps to your apartment, and you break your leg because the steps are not in good condition, and it's you sue your landlord because it's his fault that you fell, evidence that he fixed the steps after you filed suit is not admissible. Now, it's clear what the policy justification is. We don't want to discourage landlords from fixing wonky steps. But it's also clear that this pulls on the whole against the truth, against getting the truth, because this would be quite strong evidence that he acknowledged that he was responsible. Okay, next slide. Once upon a time, as I assume you know, courts relied on tests by oath and by ordeal, sometimes by combat. Though that was relatively, I think, rarer. Though I gather the law about trial by combat was not actually repealed in England until sometime in the 19th century, which is kind of startling. This picture represents ordeal by cold water. The defendant is being dragged along the side of the boat. If he drowns, he will have been guilty. If he's innocent, God will save him from drowning. There was also ordeal by hot water, where the court would ask you, please plunge your right arm in this bucket of boiling water, and afterwards be taken out and bandaged. And if in a week it had gone rotten, you were guilty. And if it hadn't, God had saved you. Obviously, the basis for these tests was theological. Though I learned from some work of Professor Taruffo that it was not uncommon, in fact, for the iron bar that you were asked, the red-hot iron bar that you were asked to grasp, if the judge wanted the defendant to be acquitted, it would be allowed to cool before he touched it. Anyway. Okay, next. Of course, that's not how we do it anymore. How we do it now is increasingly to rely on scientific and, well, I have said quasi-scientific. It's a sort of fudge word for it claims to be scientific, but one might well have doubts. Testimony. Courts have always had trouble with this testimony. Next. I think the problems with Daubert are emblematic of these difficulties. There is nothing magical about my list of difficulties. There are many, many different kinds of difficulty, legal, philosophical, etc. These happen to be some on which I've expended a lot of time and thought. One is the way that Justice Blackmun manages to confuse Hopper and Pemple. I mean, sorry, Popper and Hempel. Or do I mean Pepper and... You know, right? Okay. Pepper and Hompel. Right, okay. And what I think are very interesting unclarities in the concept which is now known as evidentiary reliability. This is an example of a very, very common phenomenon. The law gets hold of an ordinary concept like drunk or crazy and turns it into a technical legal concept, so that legally intoxicated is not identical in meaning or in criteria to the ordinary concept of drunk, and legally insane is now a highly technical notion bearing relatively indirect relation to loco. Similarly, evidentiary reliability has become a legal technical term which has still some relation to the notion of reliability, you know, in which I might say, I'm wearing this watch and not the one with a black band, because the one with a black band is no longer reliable. It has some connection with that, but it's not the same concept. It's a legal concept. And then, I've written about this elsewhere, and if you ask me about it, I'll talk at more length, but I think there's an ambiguity in the Supreme Court's reference to peer review and publication, which significantly affects what this indicium of reliability means in practice. And then there is a long, long running debate over whether Daubert really is, as the rhetoric of the ruling suggests, more hospitable to letting evidence in than Fry, or less. I suspect that the answer to this is that there is no answer. It's more restrictive in some ways and less in others. But all right, next slide. I think these problems, among other things, of course, have tempted some to skepticism about the concept of truth, and hence to that refusal to use the word without the precaution of scare quotes. I think it's wonderful that the Spanish expression for this is comillas de precaución, because it's a precaution, arm's length. You're not committed to anything if you... And I think it's also encouraged a kind of strong social constructivist conception of the sciences. I don't mean that this is the only reason why these ideas are so popular in law schools around the United States. They are, both of them, very popular around law schools in the US. Part of the explanation is simply that law professors are attracted to radical philosophy. When they want to do philosophy, they want it to be big and exciting, not commonsensical and unexciting, even if it's true. Okay. All right, next. What I'm going to do is to develop instead an account of truth that sustains the objectivity of the concept, and an account of science which is not non-objectivist, but is thoroughly fallibilist. Okay. And next. What I shall offer here, of course, is not... I know what this is, what they expected. They wanted me to give the philosophical perspective on truth. And one of the things I had to say very firmly was, there is no such thing as the philosophical perspective on truth. I am giving you my philosophical perspective on truth. And then I quoted... what I think is the best line that Nicholas Rescher ever wrote from The Strife of Systems: if two people agree, one of them isn't a philosopher. I was actually once with Rescher at a conference on pragmatism, where he was in essence urging the virtues of a Persian pragmatism against a Rortiesque pragmatism. And I teased him about this line, because I said, okay, which of us isn't the philosopher? I agree with everything you said. But he does have a very good point. Okay, next. So, first of all, talk about truth in science. I call my approach critical common sensism. That's an expression borrowed from Peirce, who constructed it in turn because he thought his philosophy borrowed something from Reed's philosophy of common sense and from Kant's critical philosophy. So that's the origin of this phrase. The first thing I want to do is to distinguish between truth, that's the concept, the abstract noun referring to a concept, and truths, that's the concrete noun referring to particular true propositions, statements, claims, theories, whatever you like. Okay. This distinction is marked grammatically in English and also in Spanish, luckily, by the fact that in the concrete use, the second use, but not the first, the abstract use, truth can take either the indefinite article, a truth, or the plural form, truths. Okay. So, next. Some examples, some very, very famous examples. The opening sentence of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Right? If an English speaker knows no other sentence from Jane Austen, he knows this one. It is the truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. A truth universally acknowledged. That's the point I want to stress here. I should explain to you what it means. It doesn't mean must want a wife. It means must be in need of a wife. And the context is that a single man in possession of good fortune has just moved into the village, and all the young women in the village are thinking, he must need a wife. Next. And if you scratch any American student, they can come up with at least this sentence. They may not have the vaguest idea what the date of the Declaration of Independence was, but they know this sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That's the second sentence of the American Declaration of Independence. And there they are, signing it. Okay. Next. Now we also need to distinguish truth and truths from truth and truths. Okay. I wish there was a way of pronouncing these things. Have you ever seen Victor Borja on television? Oh. He's a very, very funny man, one of whose funny tricks was to read the punctuation in things that he was reading aloud. So he would go, pew, pew, right, so, pew, truth, pew. Okay. The exclamation point was particularly good. Okay, scare quotes. Are very, very significant little bits of punctuation, these are. When you stop talking about truth and start talking about truth, right? What you're doing is talking, instead of about truth, about so-called truths. Right? That's to say, propositions which are taken to be true, but which may be true or may be false. And when you talk about truth. You're talking about so-called truth. That's to say, the supposed concept of truth. So the effect of these scare quotes is to generate an atmosphere of skepticism. And I do know many people, both in law schools and in philosophy, and not a few in literature departments also, who will simply never use words like truth and truth without scare quotes. This is so common a phenomenon. Yes, okay, I have a story for you. Once I went to speak at the University of New Mexico in the period when, if you didn't stay over Saturday night, your airfare was double what it would otherwise be. And they didn't have enough money for me not to stay over Saturday night. But they said, we will give you a really good time on Saturday, so to compensate. Well, they took me to Santa Fe for the day, which was wonderful. It's a very, very nice mountain city. It was Halloween, and in the evening, they took me to a Halloween party. You know what Halloween is. Everybody has to wear fancy dress. I had no fancy dress. So I did a deal with the tallest faculty member in the department. And we went to the party with me dressed just as I was, and him dressed just as he was, but he walked behind me everywhere I went, doing this. And when they asked, what are you? I said, I am plain truth, and he is the scarecrow. My best Halloween ever. Okay, next. Now I am going to use these two distinctions. Okay. First of all, I think there is one truth, just one concept. many conceptions of truth, of course, but just one concept. But there are many truths, many true propositions. Truth, the concept, is not relative. But some truths only make sense relativized to a place and a time, including legal truths, which make sense, in my opinion, only relativized to a jurisdiction and a time. So that I can say the Fry rule remains in force in Florida in 2010. Right? But I can't just say the Fry rule remains in force. That's an incomplete claim. And because scare quotes, truths, are not really, are only so-called truths, some of them are actually false. Okay, next. All right, now I have to tackle science. As you know from an earlier lecture, I like to use the word science or the sciences to refer to a federation of kinds of inquiry. And I take it to be part of the meaning of inquiry that what you're trying to do if you're inquiring is to find the answer to some question or some questions. And I take it to be a tautology that if you're trying to find the answer to a question, what you want is the true answer. Okay. I take this to be a very simple, low-key sort of truth. This is nothing big. It's obvious, simple, plain. Okay, next. That doesn't mean that scientists are seeking the truth, all in capital letters. Not the truth in the sense in which Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No, nothing like that. It just means if you're trying to determine whether the earth goes around the sun or the sun goes around the earth, you want to end up believing that the earth goes around the sun just in case the earth does go around the sun. That's all it means. It doesn't mean you're looking for the Holy Grail. Okay. Okay, next. This is consonant with, it would take a lot of work to explain exactly how all this fits together, but I think it's clear on its face that what I just said about what it means to say that a scientist is seeking the truth is clearly consonant with a theory of truth like Ramsay's. Ramsay says that a belief is true if it's the belief that P and not otherwise. He goes on to say, this is so banal, I'm almost embarrassed to say it. But somebody's got to say it, because there is no truth so obvious that eminent philosophers have not denied it. All right, okay. I call this the Laconicist theory of truth, for two reasons. The first is that while the usual name is the redundancy theory, that's clearly inappropriate, because Ramsay was well aware that while true is redundant in sentences like, it's true that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. There you can just nod it off, just means Caesar crossed the Rubicon. It's not redundant in Aristotle said some true things. You can't just make that Aristotle said some things and doesn't mean the same. Okay. So redundancy is wrong. And the next question is, well, what's the best new name? I have chosen laconicism. Laconic means terse, short, Spartan. Okay. I wish this was my coinage. It isn't. This expression was invented by a former student of mine, Kiriaki Zerohomona. As you can gather from her name, she has an unfair advantage in coining philosophical terminology. She is Greek. No fair. It's very easy if you're Greek. Okay. Next. Scientific theories, of course, come into being by means of things that scientists do. Right? They're not lying around to be discovered. They have to be constructed. So in that sense, scientific theories are a social construction. Okay. But what makes them true or makes them false is whether the phenomena or the events or whatever it is that they describe are the way that they describe them. So that the truth of scientific theories is not socially constructed, even though the scientific theories themselves might be so described. Next. Okay. Truth, that's the concept, is by my lights objective. In this sense. Okay. Normally, whether P is true or it's false doesn't depend on whether you believe it or I believe it or anyone believes it, or whether anyone believes that it's false. The normally is to take care of a small subclass of propositions which are about what somebody believes. Okay, those will be an exception to this, but it's very, very complicated to spell out, so I've just done the lazy thing and called it, said normally. You know what's intended by that. It doesn't follow from the fact that truth is objective that scientists are objective, if that means that they are always unbiased. Of course they are not. I believe that every scientist there has ever been or ever will be has some preconceptions about how he expects things to turn out. And of course, as soon as he's been working on something for a few years, he has an investment in it turning out the way that he's proceeding as if it were, because he's simply wasted several years if he turns out to be wrong. So the objectivity of scientific truth is perfectly compatible with the existence of bias of one kind and another, even in every single scientist that there has ever been. Next. You see why I put these things in this order. The evidence with respect to any scientific claim, I'm sorry about the typo, is complicated, it's ramifying, it has the structure of a crossword. And I think this is an important point. We use the word science as if it was just one big gob, right, all the same. It's not. Right, not only are there different branches with very different procedures and so forth, instruments and so on, and cultures. There are also, if you look at the whole range of scientific claims and theories, they go all the way from the so firmly warranted that you would be just astonished if they turned out to be false. Suppose it turned out that after all the sun does go round the earth. I would be absolutely astounded, not just surprised, astounded. Or suppose it turned out that, after all, protein is the genetic material and not DNA. Whoa! Okay, so there's stuff that's really, really well grounded in evidence. And there's stuff that's fairly well grounded, but not by any means as warranted as it might be. And there's stuff that just came down the pike yesterday that's pure speculation. As yet, there is no evidence really one way or the other. It might be true, for all we know. And it's an interesting idea. But it's very important, I think, that scientific claims fall on the whole range of a possible scale of epistemic status, from the very well established to the highly speculative. All right, next. Scientific method. My story is there is no such thing. There is only the procedures of ordinary empirical inquiry and an extraordinary range of scientific helps. And of course there are two quite distinct concepts which law professors have a hell of a time discriminated for some reason. I don't know why. One is warrant, which is an epistemological concept and means roughly how good the evidence with respect to this claim is. And the other is consensus, which is how many people in the relevant scientific community accept this claim. Now, when everything works well, when nothing interferes with the process of scientific inquiry, when nobody's pushing or pulling to get this answer rather than that, warrant and consensus will more or less align. Right? The better the evidence, the more people will accept it. When things go wrong, when there's pressure from the outside, from a funding agency, for example, to reach this conclusion rather than that, then the two start to diverge. Okay. Now, one very interesting thing about sociology of science, or at least recent sociology of science, not Merton, but since about the 1980s, is that they started pretending that consensus and such are epistemological concepts, and forgetting about warrant altogether. And so they call what they do epistemology, even though it's completely devoid of any normative elements at all. It's purely descriptive about agreement in the community. Okay, next. I'm going back to one of the earliest sociologists of science, Robert Merton. I really greatly admire Merton's work. I think Merton understood science quite well and wrote about its place in society very illuminatingly. It's now fashionable to denigrate him and to say, you know, he's hopelessly old-fashioned, we're much better than that. I don't think anything that's happened since is nearly as good as Merton. So back to Merton. Merton has a list of scientific values. He's asking, how might a society encourage these values or discourage them? Two of the most important, I think, are what he calls disinterestedness. I call it respect for evidence. That's to say, being honest about how much evidence you've got, whether you have enough evidence to say anything, whether you have enough evidence to say maybe, 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 or you bet this is the case. And what he calls communism, terribly unfortunate word. What he means by that is willingness to share evidence, which doesn't mean that a scientist has to be ready to put his most recent results on the internet so that everybody can see them, but does mean that he won't withhold them from other people in the field. For example, because the information is proprietary. It belongs to this firm, right, and therefore is legally to be protected. Okay. Right. Now, I think that these values so far have been more or less, and I intend more or less very seriously, frequentemente menos, often less, but up to a point they've been sustained within the sciences by internal social mechanisms, like peer review, like the disincentive of loss of reputation if you are found to have committed fraud. This doesn't work perfectly, as we know. You all know about Dr. Hwang Woo Suk, I take it, who was carted off in handcuffs when it was discovered that his work on cloning was completely fraudulent. Scientific fraud is a criminal offense in Korea, not everywhere in the world. These mechanisms work reasonably well if there aren't strong pressures from the outside. But sometimes there are strong pressures from the outside. There are always pressures from the outside. And sometimes they get too strong and the scientific business gets in trouble. They can be threatened by the ideological values of sponsors, governments, for example, and by the commercial values of industrial concerns that support science. And I think this gets more and more important as science gets more and more expensive. Because as it's more and more expensive, it becomes less and less possible to do science without the support of some entity with an enormous amount of money. And that, in essence, means either governments or big industrial concerns. And they both have other interests besides discovering the truth. Okay, next. I take it you are familiar with the metaphor, are you? It's Carl Llewellyn's metaphor that for the law is the bramble bush. Okay. You familiar with this? You know what a bramble bush is? My students don't know, so it's okay. It's okay. You know what a blackberry is? Murray? Is that right? I buy them in the supermarket and the name is on the package in Spanish. I think it's Mures. Moras. Blackberries. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the bramble is the plant on which moras grow. A characteristic of this plant is, you start with a little twig. You plant a little twig. And the first year, it grows. And the next year, poof, you have a big hedge. And the year after that, you have a thicket of stuff, right, which you can't penetrate. That's what the law is like. It's a very good metaphor. You know, you have one little thing, and then all sorts of qualifications and ramifications and blah. Moreover, a bramble bush is covered in prickles. Okay, so science in the bramble patch. Why doesn't it work any better than it does? Well, first of all, the legal system or law tends to call on weaker areas of science rather than stronger. You know, you very rarely have a theoretical physicist showing up in court, because that's not the kind of thing on which legal disputes often turn. A colleague of mine in the physics department tells me he was once an expert witness in a murder case. He testified that according to the laws of classical mechanics, the victim could not have fallen from here to there, but must have been pushed. But this is very rare. Usually, it's the weaker areas of science, especially of the social sciences and the forensic sciences, on which the law is calling. Second thing is that in the nature of the case, the law tends to bring in marginal scientists, by which I mean, if you've got a range of scientific opinion, from those who think this drug is very dangerous to those who think it's probably harmless, it's almost certainly harmless, it's beyond question that it's harmless, then the people you will see in court as expert witnesses are those from this end who think clearly it's dangerous, and people from this end who think clearly it's harmless, because these are more useful to the parties than the wishy-washy people in the middle. Okay. Moreover, the legal system can distort even good scientific information. I mean, information may be perfectly solid, no problem, but an attorney, on direct examination of his witness, may push him to overstate it, to overinterpret what we know. And of course, sometimes the law creates artificial scientific doubt or artificial scientific certainty. I'll give you some examples of this in a little while. Moreover, okay, next slide. The law may sometimes suppress or sequester relevant information. It might ask for answers from science when the only honest answer a scientist could give would be, we don't know yet. You know, the law needs an answer when the law needs an answer. But the science has an answer when science has an answer. And these may not be the same time. And of course, scientific theories are almost invariably general, whereas legal cases are particular, and there's always room for something to go wrong when you apply the general theory to this particular instance. And, next slide, this is the burden of yesterday afternoon's talk. Sometimes the law holds back what may be reasonably strong evidence because evidence law is so atomistic. I didn't say this yesterday, but perhaps I will today. One of the ironies of the US system, I think, is that while evidence law is very atomistic, one of the rules of criminal procedure, one of the rules of civil procedure also says the court should take account of all the available evidence. This is kind of odd because it's in tension with what evidence law obliges them to do. And of course the law may fail to adapt or adapt only very, very slowly when science is rushing ahead. Okay, so let's go through these with some examples. Why do I say the law tends to call on weaker areas of science? Well, because legally relevant science is often still speculative rather than fully settled. You know, if it were fully settled, either the plaintiff would never bring the case or the defendant would settle it fast. Okay, it's when nobody quite knows whether this stuff caused the damage that you'll have the tort case, for example. Moreover, the science that's presented in tort cases is very often science that was conducted by the manufacturers of products or of drugs or of medical devices, either for marketing purposes or to get FDA approval, Food and Drug Administration approval, or because they know there is going to be litigation and they're trying to protect themselves. And in criminal law, of course, what's being called on is usually forensic science. And that's some of the weakest stuff. I mean, DNA is as good as it gets, but some of the other stuff, like hair analysis, is really, really weak indeed. Though I don't like the concept of pseudoscience. I am tempted to say of some areas of forensic science. Okay. Each party, of course, will seek out experts favouring its side, and that means they'll call on people who are more sure one way or the other than most scientists in the field, and many of whom, because they are more sure than most people in the field, will have become expert witnesses by profession. And I believe it's a psychological fact about human beings. I think there is reasonably robust psychological research supporting this, but I've always noticed this about people. Once you have said something decisively in public, your own attitude solidifies. You become more sure because you expressed yourself certainly. So that you get these professional expert witnesses who get more and more and more dogmatic as time goes on. Right, there's a dreadful man called Dr. Brent who was a witness for Merrill Dow in the Benedictine litigation. Over and over and over and over. He had been on retainer for 18 years, during which 18 years he was the editor of a journal called Teratology. That means the science of birth defects, basically, in which he published only stuff that was favorable to Benedictine, including much stuff written by himself. And he had even written a paper which described Benedictine as the best known tortigan litigant. Right, that's to say, the best known drug for creating tort litigation. Okay, that's the kind of thing I mean. I don't mean they're only on one side. Dr. Dunn, who appeared many times for the plaintiffs in Benedictine cases, was also a professional expert witness and also pretty dogmatic. Okay. Even good scientific information gets distorted because both sides have an incentive to overinterpret whatever they have. Sometimes they have an incentive to resist good science. For example, when DNA identification first became possible, in the US at least, there was intense resistance to this on the part of defense attorneys. Right. Such intense resistance that people began to talk about the DNA wars. It took 5, 6, 7 years before the power of DNA evidence was universally admitted. And when the first DNA exonerations came to light, when people who had been convicted were discovered by DNA tests to be innocent of the crime of which they'd been convicted, prosecutors resisted like mad. Right. You would have rock solid DNA evidence that this guy wasn't the rapist. And prosecutors would show up and say, no, he should stay in jail. For all we know, there were two rapists, one of whom wore a condom, and that was this guy. Right, the crazy ad hoc explanations they were coming up with. They didn't want to let people go. Okay, next. Artificial scientific doubt. I think there have been two cases in the recent history of the US legal system. I am, of course, sticking my neck out because I'm saying I am reasonably sure that these things are harmless. I'm reasonably sure that those silicon breast implants, over which there was an enormous, enormous flood of litigation, are actually harmless and don't cause connective tissue disease. And I'm actually even surer that MMR vaccination, that's mumps, measles and rubella vaccination, does not cause autism. Interestingly enough, I wrote this paper before the man who wrote the article scaring everybody that this vaccine might be responsible for the considerable rise in autism admitted that the whole thing was terrible stuff. Okay. All right, next. And then there's sequestering scientific information, which may often a company will withhold information on the grounds that it's proprietary. That's to say, it belongs to them and it's capable of making them a profit, right? So that it's commercially valuable and it can't just be given away. Okay. A melodramatic case was the case of the Immune Response Corporation, which developed, it was a company actually founded by Jonas Salk, who invented the polio vaccine. And this gave the company a sort of prestige. It came up with an AIDS therapy. It was supposed to be an immune system booster called Remune. They set up a big clinical trial. It soon became apparent this stuff was totally ineffective. The people in the trial who took Remune were dying at exactly the same rate as the people who didn't, and they were getting sicker at exactly the same rate as the people who didn't. The scientist who conducted this trial for the company wanted to publish the results. The company tried to get an injunction to prevent him from publishing. He published anyway. He said, "No, the hell with you, I'm publishing anyway." And they sued him for $10 million for publishing the truth about the drug, saying this was proprietary information. Unfortunately, we don't know the details of this litigation against the scientists because by contract it went to arbitration and not to a public trial. Arbitration proceedings are not public. We do know what the upshot was. The Immune Response Corporation was awarded the sum of $0. Okay, so I take it that they thought that the company's case was worthless. Now there is, by the way, a codicil to this story. I wrote a paper about this extraordinarily sleazy episode a while back. A couple of months ago, I got a telephone call from California from a man, he was an investment banker, who had invested a very large sum of money in another medical company founded after Immune Response went bankrupt by the CEO of Immune Response, and he tells me he is playing the same games again. Anyway, next. What I mean by fumbling the application to the specific case is, for example, that even very, very solid DNA identifications can be completely undermined by sloppy labeling in the laboratory, for example. It doesn't matter if it's a trillion to one that this sample came from the defendant, if it's 100 to 1 that this isn't the right sample. Okay. And then, next, evidentiary atomism. Well, that was the burden of yesterday's paper, so I won't say any more about it. And then, next, adapting very slowly when science moves on. The DNA wars would be one example. Another, which is kind of interesting historically, is that the Frye case was about whether or not very primitive lie detection evidence should be admitted. It was very primitive. All it did was measure changes in systolic blood pressure under questioning. By the time that Florida adopted Frye, which was in 1952, in a case called Kaminsky, the lie detector test in question was a polygraph, not a monograph. The science had moved on, but the law was very old law for very old technology. Okay, next. You know what I'm thinking is there's certain, if there are properties that the sciences have which pull against properties, values of the legal system. So, for example, the fallibilism of the sciences, the willingness to revise anything if the evidence turns out that way, pulls against the legal concern for finality. You know, this is a cartoon from the Florida Bar Association Journal, where the attorney, you see that the foreman of the jury has a sign saying, all verdicts are final. And an attorney is saying to him, no, Mr. Murdoch, I understand you have a job as a salesman. He's a car salesman. All right, next. And now, finally, I understand how scientific truths get entrenched as legally reliable. Why? Well, I think true has the same meaning as applied to legal as to other propositions. But truths to the effect that the law is thus and so are always relative to a jurisdiction and relative to a time. For example, Michigan is a Daubert state is true only relative to times after the 1st of January 2005. Okay, in 1st of January 2005, Michigan switched from Frye to Daubert. How do I know this? Why does it stick in my memory? Not because I live in Michigan, but because I have a friend who is an attorney in Michigan, who was, when I first met him, an enormously successful trial lawyer taking only what we call bad baby cases. Rather unkind description, but he took only cases where the plaintiff was suing an obstetrician claiming that the baby had been damaged during birth. Okay. He was enormously successful. He was bringing in million dollars in verdicts. But he was very good at this under Frye. Michigan changed the law to Daubert. He didn't adapt quickly enough, and by the end of 2005, his firm had fired him. He had 2 weeks to empty his office and no job and no prospects. That is really scary, but what it rubs in. Okay, you can just change the law. You can turn on a dime. The legislature decides we're going to Daubert. Then on January the 1st, different rules apply. Okay. I think, I know this will be controversial, but sometimes there are legal truth value gaps. I think between 1975 and 1993, it was neither true nor false that the Federal Rule of Evidence 702 had superseded Frye. There was simply no true answer to that question until the Supreme Court decided it. And, of course, legal truths are made true by legal decisions. Okay, still with me. Next. Now, we routinely distinguish, me as well as everybody else, between questions of fact and questions of law. Seems like a clear enough distinction. But there are some instances which exactly straddle this distinction. Take Daubert's concept of evidentiary reliability. I think it's, do you know the expression, a Janus concept? You know the Greek god Janus is always portrayed as facing both ways. Okay, it's a Janus concept. I mean, it faces in two directions. One side of this concept is factual. Justice Blackmun talks about reliability in terms of trustworthiness, okay, which is the ordinary English sense. But it also has a legal face, because evidentiary reliability is determined not by the jury, which is the fact finder, but by the court, which is the legal referee. So it's got both a factual face and a legal face. Next. And this creates a problem, because claims about evidentiary reliability can be made true by a legal decision. If a judge says, yes, this is reliable enough to be admitted, then legally it is reliable enough to be admitted. Okay. And this creates an illusion that by legal magic, legal deeming, you can create scientific truths. But you can't. You can't. There is no way that a judge doing anything can create a scientific truth. He can create a legal truth, but he cannot create a scientific truth. And next. Sadly, I regret to say, I wish this weren't the case, but the scientific propositions that get legally entrenched as reliable, evidentiarily reliable, are probably, more often than we would like, not true, but false. That's to say, they're not scientific truths, they're only scientific truths. Next.